small stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another solar system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, 1 centimeter, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and welcome to Sharing Science Radio on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia on unceded Musqueam lands in Vancouver, Canada. I'm Al Manning, and I'm this week's host, and in fact, I'm the only host this week. Back next week, we're going to have regular three-person team, but this week, it's just myself. Before I dive into this week's topic, I just want to mention that we now have an email address for the show. You can reach us at radio@ubcsharingscience.org. If you have any questions or comments, or you'd like to hear about a specific topic, or even if you can just drop us a line, because honestly, we don't know who our audience is. We're a new show, and we'd love to hear what sort of direction you want us to take this show in. So please drop us a line. That's radio@ubcsharingscience.org. And you can also find us online at ubcsharingscience.org/radio. Okay, so what's going down on this week's show? Well, we are talking medical imaging, and specifically the past and the future of medical imaging devices, what they can see, what they can't see, and some of the interesting technologies that allow us to look inside the body. You could also call this week's show Looking Inside Things Without Opening Them Up. Because that's exactly what medical imaging is, looking inside things without opening them up. And you really don't want to open up a person unless you have to. You know, it's a messy business, or so I hear. So what I really want to focus on for the first part of the show is the history of the introduction of the first medical imaging technology, which was X-rays. This was really revolutionary, and it was an example of a technology that was adapted extremely rapidly. And it was also an example of a technology that sort of unlocked portions of people's imagination. So what do I mean by that? I remember I was in an escape room game. So this is one of these places you go with a couple buddies and you get locked into a room. There's a bunch of puzzles and you have to solve these puzzles and get out within, say, half an hour or an hour or whatever. Anyways, there was one point in the game where we had this stupid combo just in this box, and we had to get inside this box somehow. We never figured it out. But I just remember thinking, like, man, if I could just get an X-ray of this box or stick it in an MRI scanner or something, I know the thing is in there. I just can't see it. So I was able to imagine being able to look inside this thing without opening it up because, I've grown up with the concept of X-rays. I think most people are familiar with the concept of X-rays. But back in the late 1800s, no one had any idea this was possible. You know, a solid object was a solid object. You can't see through it. If you want to see inside it, you gotta break that thing open. Same goes for a person, for the human body. You want to see inside that thing? Well, get out your scalpel, because that's pretty much the only way. That's why I think X-rays are really kind of interesting to look at. Most of the stuff I'm talking about the show is taken from these great books. The first one is called Naked to the Bone. It's by Betty Ann Holtzman Keevils. The second one is by Nancy King. It's called A New Light, X-rays and Medical Futurism, and you'll find that in the book Imagining Tomorrow, which is edited by Joseph J. Korn. If you kind of are interested in learning more about this, I recommend you check out those books. They're really quite great. Let's kind of set the scene for the introduction of X-rays in 1895. The world then was this mixture of the old and the new. In the Western world, you're on the tail end of the Industrial Revolution. In England, you're on the tail end of the Victorian era. World War I wasn't far away, 1914, and that's sort of considered to separate this older time from our more modern time. In terms of science, things were pretty modern. There was the first hints of understanding quantum theory. That's sort of the theory of the very small, which underlines a lot of modern physics. Einstein wasn't far away with the theory of relativity, special and general. And in terms of biology, there was the first hints of an understanding of genetics. And medicine was surprisingly modern. You always kind of read about medicine in ancient times and just shudder. You know, what if you were transported in a time machine back to the Dark Ages and the medieval time, and God forbid you broke your arm or had some horrific accident, and they took you to whatever passed as a doctor. You know, they probably bleed you, get out the bone saw, chop off some limbs. Probably the cure is worse than the disease, for sure. But late 1800s was a good time. There was vaccines, there was antiseptic, there was an understanding of germ theory, and thank goodness there was anesthetic. But medical imaging was kind of non-existent. You had devices like endoscopes that could go down your mouth or up your bum and check out your insides. Again, if you want to look inside the tissue, that's a solid object. There's no way to do that. So that was kind of the scene. People were thinking that the future of medicine is not going to be technology. Back then, people thought the future of medicine would be sort of better public health, better hygiene, better nutrition, which is certainly true. But I think if you ask someone nowadays, what is the future of medicine going to be? People are going to say, oh yeah, there's going to be like these robots and we're going to have this advanced imaging technology and there's going to be crazy biotech and you can like clone your ear and if you get your ear cut off, you could like fuse the new one to your head. That idea was not even present in people's image of the future in the late 1800s because there was not really, medicine was not associated with a lot of technology. All right, so the stage is set for the discovery of X-rays. So the guy who discovered this was called Wilhelm Röntgen. I'm just going to call him Röntgen. Sorry for my pronunciation. And he was working in his lab late one night in November 1895. He was playing around with something called a Crookes tube. And basically in a Crookes tube, there's no air, but there's electrons zipping back and forth between two metal plates. Röntgen didn't know these were electrons, by the way. That wasn't proven until later. But he was playing around with his Crookes tube, and he noticed that nearby, a couple meters away, there was this photographic plate that was glowing. And at the time, there was no film for cameras, so basically the way he took a picture was he had a photographic plate, which is a plate smeared with chemicals that were reactive to light. So Röntgen noticed this was glowing, which was kind of weird, because he knew that the particles inside the Crookes tube could not travel through the air. They would collide with the air molecules and slow down. So there was some weird, unknown, unseen, at least to humans, ray that was traveling from the Crookes tube all the way to the photographic plate. And Röntgen called this ray, this unknown thing, the X-ray, X being for unknown. And he kind of freaked out. He basically shut himself in his lab for the next 5 weeks, had all his meals brought to him, and of that time, he later said, I didn't think I experimented. So after 5 weeks, he alerted all of his scientific buddies that he had figured something out. He wrote up a little report and sent it out to various scientific societies. Included in this report is a very famous picture. You may have seen it. It's one of the first X-rays, and it's of his wife's hand. You can clearly see all the bones of her hand, and there's a lump where a wedding ring is. And even for something that's 130 years old-ish, it's relatively modern looking. So this was really cool. Hidden solids revealed, declared the New York Times on January 1896. People were really excited and started going out and building their own X-ray machines because it was relatively easy to make and playing around with them. And people also didn't have any idea of the adverse side effects of X-rays. So they were just trying them out for all sorts of crazy purposes. I mean, think of all the uses we would have for X-rays now if we didn't know about their adverse side effects. There were all sorts of crazy applications. Again, some of them seem kind of odd today, but keep in mind that if you don't know anything about a subject, and no one knew anything really about X-rays or didn't know very much, there's no stupid question, right? X-rays can make the unseen seen, so maybe they can make the seen unseen. Maybe they can make things invisible. You know, they tried making things invisible, or they tried to cure blindness, or people thought, well, the X-rays are kind of a weird thing, so maybe they can raise the dead. Needless to say, those experiments did not proceed with much success, although one person did claim that they changed lead into gold. And of course, people were like, well, we can X-ray, we can see through stuff, so could we see people's thoughts? Can we see what they're thinking? William Randolph Hearst, who was a newspaper publisher and always one for a good story, or would make one up if he didn't find a good story, he asked Thomas Edison to take an X-ray of the brain to see what people were actually thinking, although Thomas Edison was not able to do that. I'll talk about how X-rays work in just a few moments. You kind of get all this crazy, nutty stuff, and again, people had no idea of the safety implications, although there were warnings right from the start. But, you know, if you were playing around with your X-rays and your hair fell out, well, that's great, because now we've got a way to remove hair from the body. Perfect. No problem at all. And you can kind of look at, like, other nutty medical things that that people dreamed up around that time. You know, there was the electromagnetic comb for curing baldness, and there was Professor Wilson's magnetoconservative garments. I'm not too sure what those were for, but, you know, it sounded high-tech, and people bought them, as people do today with sort of high-tech medical-sounding things that don't actually do anything. You know, even until, like, the 1930s, and this is not X-rays, but this is actually radium. So radium is a radioactive material. It was discovered by Marie Curie and Pierre Curie. But even in the 1930s, people were going nuts over products that had radium in it. I found one advertisement for radium suppository. It was called Vita Radium Suppositories. And the ad said, after insertion, the suppository quickly dissolves and the radium is absorbed by the colon. Every tissue, every organ of the body is bombarded by this health-giving electric atom. That just sounds delightful. Who would not want radium coursing through their colon? You know, even the 1930s, people didn't really accept that radiation was harmful. Another aspect of X-rays was how they pulled back the veil on this sort of repressed Victorian sexuality. Obviously, it wasn't a huge time of expression. And when X-rays came out, all of a sudden, hey, you could see through people's clothes. You could check people out naked. And some thought this was great, and other people not so great. Keevil's quotes one rather conservative and uptight reporter, saying in 1896 that the best thing would be for all civilized nations to combine and burn all works on the Roentgen ray, to execute all the discoverers, and to corner all the tungstate in the world and whelm it in the middle of the ocean. Let the fish contemplate each other's bones if they like, but not us. I'm not too sure what tungstate is. Probably meant tungsten, which was needed for Crookes tubes. So yeah, there were varied responses to the X-ray. And some people were worried. You could buy underwear that blocked X-ray radiation back in the day. But hey, guess what? Do you remember those new airport scanners that came out, the so-called terahertz scanners? Well, you can actually buy underwear nowadays that's intentionally designed to block those because it also renders people naked. History repeating. People were worried about their private parts back in the Victorian age, and they still are now. But I'll say this much. At least we still don't shove radium up our bums. I think that's probably an improvement. If you're interested in that underwear, by the way, it's sold by Beta Brands. All right, we're going to take a quick break for a PSA. We'll be back in a few minutes, and I'll explain how the X-ray actually works.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
God, ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Oh, isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Welcome back to Sharing Science on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we're talking about medical imaging, specifically the history of X-rays. Before on the break, we talked about how X-rays, when they were introduced in 1895, really revolutionized medical technology, how they were adopted really quickly, and how people didn't really know about the dangerous side effects of X-rays. But let's talk right now about what the heck X-rays actually are. Well, they're basically light. So they're on what's called the electromagnetic spectrum. Radio waves are electromagnetic waves, light are electromagnetic waves, infrared are electromagnetic waves, so are X-rays and gamma rays. These are all basically light. And you can think of them as waves, or you can think of them as photons. And X-rays are typically quite energetic. They're more energetic than, say, blue light, which is more energetic than red light, for example. And how are they produced? Well, in a Crookes tube, you would have, first of all, there's no air in a Crookes tube. And then you'd have two plates. One of them is at a very high voltage, one's at a very low voltage. What this causes is electrons to come screaming off the plate that's at a low voltage, and they get attracted to the high voltage plate, and as they jump across the gap, they speed up, and then bam, they run into that high voltage plate, and they slow down really fast. And as they slow down, all that energy's got to go somewhere, and it gets released as X-rays. Today, basically, X-rays are produced essentially the same way. There's obviously some improvements, a lot to do with cooling, but same idea. And we know today that X-rays can actually be quite harmful to human health. So why is that? Well, they're what's known as what's called ionizing radiation. So ionizing radiation is radiation that has the potential to damage DNA. So why is that a big deal? Well, DNA is the substance inside your cell that essentially contains all the information on how that cell is supposed to run, including replication. And if you damage the DNA, it can really screw up how the cell replicates. And it can screw it up so much, in fact, the cell will just continue to replicate and won't stop. And that is a cancerous cell. And that's why you want to limit your dose of ionizing radiation as much as possible. Now, there's ionizing radiation all around us all the time. There's a lot of background radiation. From radioactive elements in the Earth, also from cosmic rays coming in from outer space. So you're being exposed to it all the time. But it's really a question of how much are you being exposed to. And that's why you want to limit your exposure as much as possible. Going back to discovery of X-rays, people didn't know this. There were clues to begin with, and unfortunately it took quite a while and probably quite a few deaths before people clued in that, hey, this X-ray thing, you know, they're not as harmless as we think. We should limit our exposure to them. Thomas Edison's technician famously had a horrific death over the course of years. There was amputations. There were all these like weird skin lesions because he was the one that was always holding the Crookes tubes. Now, people did eventually figure out the news about X-rays and radiation in general and how harmful they can be. So if X-rays are harmful, then why do we still use them? Well, mainly because the amount of exposure we get from X-rays nowadays is significantly reduced from the first X-rays. Back then, say in the early 1900s, people would sit for half an hour or an hour while the X-ray machine is on in order to get a good image. But today, there's so much improvement in terms of image quality that we can get X-rays in less than a second, and the amount of radiation that we're exposed to is way, way lower. Also, the medical profession is well aware of this, and you won't be exposed to radiation in medical imaging unless it's for a very good reason. So that kind of wraps up the history of the introduction of X-rays, but I just want to talk quickly about how X-rays are actually used in a lot of different areas of science. So I mentioned earlier that X-rays are part of this electromagnetic spectrum. You can think of them as a type of light. And in fact, NASA has a telescope up orbiting the Earth that observes the universe in X-rays. So you can think of it as like a Hubble Space Telescope for X-rays. I mentioned that X-rays are particularly energetic. So we actually find X-rays around black holes because black holes, there's super high energy. They're sucking in lots of things. Things are whipping around really fast. So if you want to learn more about that, you can look up the Chandra X-ray Observatory. You can see some really cool pictures from that. X-rays also allow us to figure out how crystals are made up of atoms and molecules. A lot of solids are crystals, which basically means that the atoms or molecules that make them up have periodic repeating patterns. And that determines a lot of their electrical properties. Okay, so far, sounds kind of boring, right? What's the application? One of the applications is the transistor, which makes up the integrated circuit, which makes up all the electrical devices that we have today. And the cool thing about this is that the X-ray allowed the transistor and basically computers to be developed, and those in turn allowed the next generation of medical imaging technology to be developed as well. So that's such a great example, I think, of how new science enables new technology, which in turn enables new science, which enables new technology. So there's really this kind of back and forth between science and technology. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show, and there's two more things that I want to talk about. I did kind of consider going through all the different medical imaging technologies, explaining how they worked, but I don't think that would make for a very exciting radio show. So if you're interested in learning more about the differences between an MRI and, say, a CAT or CT scan, you can look that stuff up online. Or you can check out the links that I'll post on the radio show notes. That's at ubcsharingscience.org/radio. The last portion of the show today will be dedicated to a new technology that have a lot of people concerned about their privacy. And no, it's not just being able to look at your junk in unprecedented detail. More on that in a few minutes. But first, now, I want to talk about two medical imaging technologies that Canada is actually heavily involved in. You might remember last year there was quite a bit of news associated with Canada's isotope production. So what the heck was that all about? They're referring to radioactive isotopes, and these are substances that are useful for medical imaging and cancer therapy. So I'm going to focus on the medical imaging side of things today. So basically, if you go in for what's called a SPECT or PET scan, prior to the scan, you'll be injected with a substance that it actually contains a little bit of radiation. It's a little bit radioactive. And the PET or SPECT scanner will detect this radioactivity in your body, and that's how it builds up its image. So why do we do this? The reason is that it allows you to image very specific things. Let's take an example. So cancer cells have a much higher metabolism than non-cancerous cells. That means they consume sugar, such as glucose, much faster than non-cancerous cells. What you can do is you can create a special sugar molecule that has a radioisotope on it. So this molecule is a little bit radioactive. When you're injected with this molecule, the cancer cells will selectively uptake the sugar much faster than non-cancerous cells. So what you get is an accumulation of radioactivity in the tumors themselves. And that enables the PET or SPECT scanner to very precisely pick up on tumor location and size. So that's pretty cool and useful. Another example is tagging oxygen. So you can create an isotope of oxygen called oxygen 15 that's a little bit radioactive. And you can look at brain activity using a PET scan. We'll have more on brain activity using MRI in just a few seconds. I just want to quickly mention, though, that Canada produces a lot of the world's radioisotopes for medical imaging in a facility at Chalk River, Ontario. And that facility uses a nuclear reactor to produce the isotopes, and it's due to shut down next year. So that's kind of bad news for isotope production. But at Triumph, which is a particle physics lab here at UBC, they're researching ways to produce isotopes without a nuclear reactor. Instead, they use something called a cyclotron, and this technology is now being sold all over the world. I think we'd really like to do a show on this in the future because it's pretty neat and an example of how basic research will eventually lead to technological breakthroughs. So stay tuned for that sometime in the next couple months. Okay, so the last topic is one I'm super excited to talk about, and that's called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. I bet you're probably familiar with MRI. You might have even had an MRI scan before. The way that this particular technology works is basically by putting you into an extremely strong magnetic field and pinging you with radio waves. And what happens to matter when it's in a strong magnetic field is that it actually produces a radio wave echo. So MRI scanners use this physical phenomenon along with some clever computer programming to build up an image of your body. The nice thing about MRIs is that there's no ionizing radiation. You're only being exposed to radio waves. And radio waves are on the electromagnetic spectrum, but they're a low enough energy, they have less energy than light, that they can't cause any damage to your DNA. MRI scans are used a lot for soft tissue imaging and brain imaging. The disadvantages are that MRI scans take a long time. And during that time, the patient is kind of shoved into this tube, and it can be very loud, very claustrophobic. A friend of mine described an MRI scan as dubstep in a tube, and I think that's a pretty accurate description. Now, if you like listening to Skrillex and you can lie there stuck in a tube listening to that for an hour, then perhaps an MRI scan is for you. If not, though, it can be a bit of a trying experience. So functional magnetic resonance imaging allows you to look at brain activity in real time. So you could be stuck into an MRI scanner and shown pictures of, say, I don't know, food or something, or maybe Skrillex, and different portions of your brain would respond to the stimuli, and researchers using the MRI scanner could actually look and see these areas of your brain lighting up. Okay, maybe that's a bad use of language. Your nerve cells don't actually light up when they fire, but basically what's happening is that as a nerve cell's fired, it needs more oxygen and more sugar, glucose, so that it can fire again. So the blood flow to areas of your brain that are active will actually increase, and you can detect that using an fMRI scanner. Okay, so here's an example of how this is used. There was a 2003 study published by Eisenberger et al. In the journal Science, and this is looking at something that we've all felt before, rejection. You know, when it just gets you right in the feels, and it almost feels, just like physical pain. So these people actually looked at, does rejection cause physical pain? So they stuck people in an MRI scanner and then had a virtual reality game where you're throwing a ball around with a bunch of other people. And then after a while, you get rejected and no one throws the ball to you anymore. And they looked at the response in the brain. And these researchers found that the anterior cingulate cortex, which is associated with physical pain, will actually become active when you experience rejection. I think this is something that people kind of knew beforehand, but now using fMRI, we can actually prove it using science. Okay, now I said earlier that people were concerned about privacy with regard to fMRI. People thought, well, hey, maybe we can use this fMRI thing to detect if people are lying, or maybe use it to get inside their thoughts. This is kind of going back to the idea of using x-rays to figure out what people are thinking. There's no technology today that it can actually read your mind, but you can see what people are thinking of when they think, hey, maybe we can use this MRI scanner to detect if someone's lying. You know, stick them in the scanner, ask them a bunch of questions, and see what portion of their brain lights up. And when the lying center of your brain lights up, then we know they're lying. But unfortunately, well, actually, I would say fortunately, it's really, really hard to determine if someone's lying because, you know, lying is complicated. Sometimes you have to fabricate a story. Sometimes it's just a yes-no question. There's no real specific brain area for deception. And it varies from person to person depending on how they feel about the lie. You can tell a lie and think it's a good thing, or you can tell the truth and think it's a bad thing. So right now, no fMRI evidence has been admissible to court, but I think that's an interesting area to kind of watch out for because, you know, the original lie detector, the polygraph, has lots of problems associated with it, but we see that in court all the time. I do want to also mention that fMRI is not really that accurate. It doesn't give you very good resolution. MRI doesn't give you very good resolution, maybe about 2 millimeter resolution. So you can't really pinpoint exactly what portion of the brain is lighting up very precisely. Some people say fMRI is biology, some people say it's psychology, and some people call it blobology, just because what you're seeing is just kind of a blob. Also what you're seeing is the result of a bunch of analysis that's gone on before, a bunch of statistical and computational analysis. There was a famous paper that did an fMRI on a dead salmon. So basically they took a salmon, stuck it in an MRI scanner. The salmon was not alive at the time. They showed it pictures of male and female salmon. And then they went through all the analytical and statistical techniques that were used in fMRI at the time. And hey, they found that the salmon brains actually lights up. They got a positive result. And of course, this was nonsense. What they were trying to show is that the statistical and analytical techniques in use at the time were not very good. And that was a while ago, and it's simply, it's been improved since then. But I think it was kind of an interesting way of showing that. And the fMRI study, by the way, won an Ig Nobel Prize. So you've probably heard of the Nobel Prizes. There's also the Ig Nobel Prizes, which are given out every year for sort of funny scientific studies. Okay, so on that note of a dead salmon, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for listening. Again, please send us, drop us an email at radio@ubcsharingscience.org. If you're listening, love to get to know our audience a little bit better. Check out next week. We've got the story of recycling, what happens to a plastic bottle when you throw it in the recycling. And stay tuned next for Sam Squanch's Hideaway.